This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Play ball! It's 30 with Murdy with your host, Sweeney Murdy.
Welcome back, everybody. Hope you're all staying safe, staying home, and doing what you can to take care of yourself and your family as we wait to return to some normalcy to our lives. Whether or not there will be real baseball of some kind in 2020 is something we still aren't sure of, still waiting for the science and technology end of it to dictate where the rest of us go in this current state of the world. In the meantime, many of us in the sports world continue to get our sports fix by going back and watching classic games. Normally, I find myself too busy to dig into the treasure trove offered up on YouTube, but now with, you know, all this time on my hands, I saw that I can find dozens of old World Series games going back decades, and I fully intend to get to a number of these as we get going, but the first place I went was into a time machine back to when I was 10 years old. See, I grew up in Middletown, Pennsylvania, about a two-hour drive from Philadelphia. And in 1980, I was in fifth grade, a huge Phillies fan. I watched the Phillies win the World Series that fall, 4-2 over the Royals. And wouldn't you know that about 2 weeks ago, I found all 6 games of the 1980 World Series on YouTube and sat down to watch them again. Not like a 10-year-old, obviously, but like an almost 50-year-old who's been covering baseball professionally now for the last 25 years. A lot of things stood out. The pace of the pitchers, definitely, although there were times that slowed down, too, with runners on base or batters stepping out. There was a mystery to the opening of this series since there was no interleague play. Phillies and Royals not only never played each other, but because free agency hadn't fully kicked in yet, most of the players had never seen each other up close, except maybe for All-Star games. Plus the fact that there was one national TV game every week and no nightly highlight shows to feature the star players throughout the league, well, you get the idea. It was just a different time. The series was shown on NBC, and the announcers are all in the Hall of Fame. Joe Garagiola and Tony Kubek are both Ford Frick Award winners. The third man in the booth, none other than Tom Seaver, who was then with the Cincinnati Reds. With no official pitch counts, and in fact, no on-screen clutter whatsoever, not even the score and inning most of the time, Seaver brought one of his teammates up to the booth, Reds pitcher Paul Moskow, and he charted pitches for Seaver. They also remarked about the radar gun and said how the pitchers throwing 90 miles per hour were throwing hard. At one point, the camera actually fixed on a scout that was located, gun that was from a scout, I believe, or from the stadium, located somewhere in the stands, as opposed to just that every pitch flashing up on the screen for you to tell you how fast it was. This series featured Hall of Famers Mike Schmidt, Steve Carlton of the Phillies, George Brett of the Royals, and this was the same season in which Brett hit 390. Schmidt and Brett were both MVPs of the league in 1980. The Phillies team also featured Pete Rose and catcher Bob Boone, whose son Aaron is now the Yankees manager. He was a youngster in the stands during these games. That Phillies team had been one of the best of the late 70s, winning 3 straight NL East titles from 76 to 78, but losing in the playoffs each year, once to the Big Red Machine and twice to the Dodgers, who lost both their World Series battles to the Yankees. The Royals, meanwhile, also won 3 straight titles from 76 to 78 and lost to the Yankees all 3 years. The Phillies had gained a reputation as a team that couldn't win the big one. They finished in fourth place in 1979, fired their player-friendly manager Danny Ozark, and replaced him with Dallas Green, who openly battled with many of the players, Green a disciplinarian. After a late September rally, the Phillies won the division title over Montreal in the next to last game of the season. Then they won a best of five NLCS against Houston, a series that featured four extra inning games and is still considered one of the three or four best playoff series of all time. The Phillies beat the Royals 4-2 in the World Series. It was the franchise's first World Championship in their 98-year history. Their only other title came in 2008. 1980 is without a doubt a different era. The series is what I remember being into, especially at the baseball crazy age of 10. I've seen many of the highlight films over the years, and the clinching sixth game has been shown as a classic. But I haven't seen all six games start to finish. I'm pretty sure I fell asleep in some of the weeknight games early in that series back in 80 because they were on school nights. Games 4 and 5 were day games on the weekend. How about that? Game 6, I absolutely remember staying up for. In fact, I still have the scorecard I kept while watching in my basement back in Middletown. And then after watching this series again, I decided I wanted to talk about it some more. So I called Larry Boa, who was the Phillies shortstop in 1980. Boa went on to manage and coach in the majors for over 30 years. Our paths have crossed many times. In fact, he spent 2 years on the Yankees coaching staff under Joe Torre in 2006 and 2007. Boa is currently a special assistant in Philadelphia, where he will forever be a member of the 1980 champs. 10-year-old me would have loved to have been at the 1980 World Series, but if I told 10-year-old me, the consolation prize would be watching it again almost 40 years later and actually having a conversation with Boa about it, I think that would be okay. So forgive my selfishness in this podcast. I hope I made it an interesting listen for you nonetheless. Here is my conversation with former Philly shortstop Larry Boa. Boa, the first thing I want to ask you is, you know, you guys just finished this crazy, memorable knockdown dragout series with the Astros. It goes 5 games. You finish up in Houston on Sunday. And then Tuesday night, you're back in Philadelphia. There are 65,000 people at the Vet. I know you're exhausted, but it's obviously the World Series. What do you remember about the environment of just getting up for game one?
Well, the environment, Sweeney, was off the chart. I mean, it was, the Vet was packed, I think 65, 66,000 people. As far as being tired, I got to be honest with you, the adrenaline kicked in. Once we beat Houston to get over, you know, we had some hurdles to climb in the mid-70s. Playing the Big Red Machine and the Dodgers, and always one play here, one play there. We couldn't get over the hump. And then finally beating Nolan Ryan after he had a big lead in game 5, you know, we felt there was no pressure on us at all. We felt that the pressure was off our back. We got in the World Series, and but the adrenaline rush was unbelievable. You know, that team never won a World Series, and to feel that energy when you went out for the first, when you went out on the lines to get introduced was something special. And we knew that game one was going to be a difficult game because we didn't have our big guy on the mound. You know, he didn't have enough rest from that previous series. And yeah. And Bob Walke had to pitch, and he did a pretty good job for us.
You hit on something that I think kind of gets lost sometimes. I don't remember if a big deal was made of it at the time or not. Maybe you could tell me. But, you know, the Red Sox had a very long drought, and it was historic, and it became part of their story. The Cubs had a long drought that everybody talked about. The Phillies hadn't won. It's 97 years the Phillies are in existence going to this World Series and haven't won at all. They've only been in it two other times.
Right.
Was this long drought talked about as much as in recent years we talked about the Red Sox and the Cubs?
I don't think it was talked, that part of it wasn't talked about, but the thing that we all realized during that whole season, 1980, all we heard was about the 64 Phillies, how they blew that lead.
Right.
And we didn't know anything. I didn't know anything about the Phillies at that time. You know, I hadn't signed yet. I knew that, you know, I followed baseball, but I didn't know the history of how they blew that lead and everything. But by the end of 80, before we started the playoffs, we knew every play that happened, people reliving it. Don't pull, you know, going down the stretch, don't pull a 64 on it. So we heard that every single day. But as far as the drought, once we got to the World Series, we started reading a little bit about they've never won one. But I felt that because of what we went through against the Red Machine and the Dodgers, that sort of tested us a little bit. And I really felt, Sweeney, that this was our time. And certain things happen that you understand that in baseball, when you play baseball long enough, a play here or a play there or a big hit here. It just sort of going down the stretch there in September, we just felt it was our year. You know, we got a couple breaks, and we took advantage of them. And then, obviously, beating Nolan Ryan was special. I think once he had a lead going in the seventh inning, and he was up 5-2 at that time, his record was off the charts. And for us to come back and beat him, I sort of felt that everything was aligned for us to go on and win the World Series.
When you start game one, and the thing that stuck out to me at the broadcast, I was watching the broadcast, it's an NBC event, and it's Joe Garagiola, Tony Kubek, and Tom Seaver. Seaver was still an active player, but he's part of the broadcast. The thing that really stuck out to me is when they're discussing game one of the World Series, there's still so much mystery about the teams because interleague play wasn't a thing yet. You guys had never played any previous series like the Yankees or Dodgers had done, and free agency hadn't really truly kicked in yet, so players weren't changing teams and leagues that much. You had a lot of familiar faces in Kansas City, a lot of familiar faces in Philadelphia that had only been there. You know, Pete Rose came over from the Reds and all that. He was really the only one major free agent that had moved anywhere on either of those teams in recent years. What do you remember about the preparation for playing a team that, I mean, how many times could you have possibly seen Kansas City play game of the week and things like that, maybe the playoffs in years past?
Yeah, that's about it. We watched them on. We had some video of them playing during the season, and obviously with Brett and Akins and Otis and UL, we knew they had a good team, and you know they were sort of similar to our team. The big thing that stood out in my mind is obviously the two third basemen, Schmitty and Brett, as we know now, two Hall of Fame players, and the sort of buildup was about two great third basemen finally hooking up. But other than that, there were two teams that sort of played the same kind of baseball. We had both had good defenses, both, you know, had enough guys on the team that could steal bases. I thought our pitching did really good. We went deep into almost every game.
Yeah.
And I think that was the big advantage. I was happened to be looking about a week ago. You know, you look when you don't have anything to do, you start looking at stuff. And I'm looking at pitches thrown. We got some guys into the 120s, which is, and we didn't even think anything of that. But the one thing that stands out in my mind in game one, we were down quick 4-0. And I remember Dennis Leonard was pitching.
Yep.
And all year I had a green light. Dallas Green said, you run whenever you want. And obviously at that time, it was the third inning or fourth inning. Might have been the fourth. And he put the hold on. And I looked over in the dugout, and, you know, Dallas was concentrating on the game. And I went, you know what? I'm not going to say we were dead, but we weren't really into it.
And flat, so said, it looked like, yeah.
Yeah, we were, you know, mentally, we were probably tired than more than anything. And I just said, you know what? I think I can get a jump here. And I stole, and I made it. And Booney got a big hit, and we put us on the board. We ended up scoring, I think, 4 or 5 runs. Anyway, I got back to the dugout. Dallas said, did you see the hold? I said, yeah. I said, I saw it. He said, well, you know, if you got thrown out, you might as well just keep running. And I said, and you know, the thing about it was, I thought I could steal easy off Leonard, and it was bang, bang. I mean, it was boom, boom. A great throw to second, and I happened to get my foot in. But I remember him saying to me, he says, you know, you had the red light. And I said, yeah, I know. I said, but we got to try to make something happen here. He says, yeah, but you get thrown out there, that doesn't look too good. And I said, well, I didn't. And so, you know, he laughed after the series was over. He goes, I asked him, I said, you remember you told me about that green light, red light? And he goes, yeah. He says, I'm glad you made it, though. And I said, me too.
Bo, Tony Kubek made a very big deal out about that stolen base the entire rest of the series. Because, as you said, the Royals jumped out to this lead in game one. You've got a rookie on the mound. You know, you're down 4 runs. And
right.
Back then, today, right, trying to steal a base down 4 runs, I mean, well, nobody thinks that's a good play. But you made it work. And they were talking about that the whole rest of the series, that was a momentum changer.
I know they did. I look back at that and I listened to it. Obviously, if the analytics were involved like they are now, that would have been a definite don't even think about running. But and the other thing is, if it was the sixth or seventh inning, there's no way I would have ran. I think it was the fourth inning, if I'm not mistaken.
I think it was early. You're right.
Yeah, and that's why I said, you know what, I got to try to do something here. And it wasn't a matter of, you know, saying let's jack this team up a little bit. I just felt I could have made it. Like I said, it was a lot closer than I thought. But we went on to win the first two games at the Vet. obviously Carlton pitched in the second game, and he went 8 innings, and I think he had 9 or 10 strikeouts. He was dominant. But, you know, there were ebbs and flows in that whole series. They came up with some big hits. Our bench came through big in Kansas City to win the last game there. It was two games to two games. And in the fifth game, I think Dell Unser got a big hit for us. And Schmitty drove in a run. And that sort of propelled us, get a little momentum going back home. And I, there's no doubt, Sweeney, I respect the game of baseball. I've always respected the game of baseball, and I've never taken anything for granted. But when we landed in Philly after game five, I said, this thing's over, because I knew Carlton was on full rest, and I just felt that everything was on our side. And obviously, I wasn't going to sell anybody in the media, but I told all the players, I said, this thing's over, man. We're going to win this thing. So
I want to get back to some of these games individually with you. Series won 6 games. You mentioned game one. You came from behind for being down 4-0. Your stolen base helped lead to a run. Blake McBride had a big 3-run homer that brought you all the way back. And then Dell Unser with a big hit late in the game. And you end up winning game one. You know, Bob Walk is a rookie, and he's pitching into the 8th inning in game one. And you guys win the game 7-6. But you talked about Carlton on full rest in game 6. He was only on 3 days rest in game 2, which makes what I'm about to tell you all the more incredible in today's day and age. I want to know what you think about this. He threw 159 pitches, gave up 10 hits and 6 walks. Right. You guys helped him out with 3 double play balls, but he managed on 3 days rest to go that deep, throw that many pitches, and, you know, with the help of the defense, like you talked about, keep the team in the ballgame. That's it. I mean, he threw 300 innings that season, too. To ask him to do that, no manager does that, but I guess that's kind of what Dallas did. He liked to ride his, I mean, even in later years, Dallas had a reputation, sometimes the worst, of riding his starters too far. But, you know, it seemed like that was the thing he really had no other intention to do with Steve Carlton in game two.
Oh, yeah. He, you know, he was going to ride Carlton. I mean, he basically, every inning, he usually from about the 6th inning on, Dallas would always go down, regardless if it was during the season or playoffs. How you feeling? He didn't even come close to Carlton. It was basically the fact that he was going, for sure he was going 8 innings. And then because McGraw pitched 2 innings the game before, which probably didn't mean anything then, because if you look at McGraw, as we talk about this, he was out of bullets at the end. But Ron Reed, who to me is very underrated for our team, he did a great job all year, and he come in and pitched the 1 inning. But we got big hits again from McBride and Schmitty. I think Keith Moreland got a couple of hits too there. So, I mean, we had contributions from everybody, but it stands out in my mind because Carlton was a horse. I mean, you know, we could talk about, you can look at those innings pitched and all that stuff. This guy, when he got on the mound, man, he didn't want to come out of games. He was focused. And before that series even started, you know, he was with us on those other games what we lost with against the Dodgers and Reds. And we sort of, after a workout, you know, he said, this is our time, guys. You only get so many opportunities, and we're going to win this series. And usually when Lefty talked, it was like E.F. Hutt and everybody listened. And when he said something like that, we were all ears, and he went out and he backed it up, and it was a gutty performance. The one thing, as you said, you know, when you throw that many pitches, your command might not be what it should have been. And he walked a few people. There's no question about that. He had deep counts. That's why the pitch count was up. But I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think that we set a record for a 6-game series on double plays.
Yes.
Trio and myself. So we got a lot of ground balls. You know, both fields were AstroTurf fields, real quick surfaces. And when guys squared them up and hit them at us, you know, there's a good chance you're going to make a double play.
A couple more things about the first 2 games in Philly that I want to ask you about. You faced Dennis Leonard in game 1, Larry Gurr in game 2. Quisenberry came out of the bullpen for game 2. Now, Leonard and Gurr had been around for a while, but as we talked about, you guys never saw each other. Quisenberry had only come up, I think, the year before, and he was a dominant reliever in the American League. But what was scouting like going into that? I mean, nowadays, you know, guys prepare for their at-bats. They have hundreds and thousands of pitches they can look at on video. What were you guys doing to get ready?
Well, we basically compared Quisenberry with Gene Garber on our team. And, you know, basically submarine type pitchers, not overpowering, but great sink on the ball, make him get the ball up in the zone. Dennis Leonard at that time was more of a power pitcher. Gura was a typical left-hander that made you, if you got really impatient up there, you hit a lot of ground balls to short and third. You couldn't pull him. These meetings were, hey, don't try to pull this guy, a Randy Jones type pitcher in Gura. Wow. You know, make him stay in the middle of the field. So we had pitchers that we sort of compared the Kansas City staff to that we faced maybe during the course of the season. And it made it a little bit easier. But sometimes, you know, you look back on that, sometimes, especially now, you know, I listen to all the information some of our hitters have. I think sometimes it's overkill. Yeah. And they go up there looking for too much. And instead of see ball, hit ball, you know, they say, well, this is what the analytics said. This guy's going to throw this pitch when it counts 2-0. Sometimes you just got to use your instincts and react to the pitches. And I think that's what was good for us. You know, we were a pretty good baseball team. We could steal bases. We could hit home runs. We could hit for average. We had a good defense and our pitching was pretty good. So nothing really caught us off guard. I think Willie Mays Aiken during that series, he got hot there.
Yeah.
We thought we had a way to pitch to him, but obviously it didn't work. Because he hurt us there a few games.
He had two homers in game one. He had two homers in game four.
Right.
And Amos Otis had tremendous series.
Really right.
Hurt you guys. One of the funny things that stuck out to me that I didn't remember, I want to know what you remember about this, but Willie Aikens had an issue with the home plate umpire the entire series about where his back foot was. And at one point in game two, Bill Kunkel is the home plate umpire. He actually pulls a tape measure out of his pocket and shows Aikens where he's allowed to stand, how far back he's allowed to go. And it's this constant back and forth, I think maybe three or four different times during the series between Aikens and the home plate umpire. Do you remember any of that?
I remember two guys in that lineup that were causing a lot of problems with, because our pitchers, for the most part, they got the ball and threw it, and they didn't like waiting. And I know Amos Otis was one guy that would step out all the time, and he would stay way back in the box. But Aikens was really far back in the box. And there was an issue with that. And Dallas even said before the series, you know, when you meet at home plate, he says, I just want you guys to watch. Because we watched video of these guys when they hit as far as where they stood in the box and everything. And they were both really deep in the box. But Aikens looked like, a few times, I don't remember them measuring, but I do remember a little bit of the back and forth between the two sides about getting in the box and that.
The series goes to Kansas City. You guys finally get a little bit of a rest day.
Right.
And then you go to game three. It's a Friday night.
That was an extra inning game, I think.
Yes. Kansas City finally won, and they got on the board there. They won on a walk-off in the 10th.
Right.
There was a play, and I'm forgetting now. I forgot to write down what inning it is. I want to hear what you take about it. I told you earlier about the, you know, Seaver had made a point earlier in the series saying how you had a good arm, but it wasn't as strong as it used to be. So he's kind of knocking you down a peg. But there was a ball hit late in game three that was right at you, a hard smash.
And yeah,
ended
it
up
was.
Going off your right, you know, over your right shoulder into the outfield. Yeah. It was a big play at the time. And they
it
were
was.
Kind of debating, you know, hey, could you have gotten in front of it? Did you play it right? Did you play it wrong? What do you remember about that one?
I personally think I should have caught the ball.
Yeah.
I know when I don't, if I get an error and I usually fess up to it. I don't try to change anything. I saw that they gave the guy a hit on it.
Yeah.
And, but it, in my opinion, I have to make that play. There's no doubt in my mind. And I'm trying to think who hit it. He did square it up. There's no question about that. And I want to say,
I think it was McCray.
It might have been Hal McCray.
I should have written down who it was, but
it might have been McCray, but I remember the play.
Yeah.
I got to catch that ball, even though the turf was quick and he did square it up. The ball, it didn't fool me, but it got to me a little bit quicker than I thought. And, you know, push coming to shove, I probably could have jumped in front and not knocked it down. I tried to catch it, but it should have been caught. No question about that.
There's another part of that game three that, you know, blew me away watching it now, you know, knowing how, you know, everybody measures the game a certain way now. Mike Schmidt is one of the greatest power hitters we've ever seen, right?
Tried to bunt.
Yes.
He tried to bunt.
In the eighth inning of a tie game
with
the go-ahead run at third base and two outs.
Yep.
He tried to bunt.
Oh, and he got buried for that too. Trust me, in a good way. I mean, nobody's. I mean, what are you doing? I mean, one of the most prolific power hitters in baseball at that time, and still to this day. And he saw the guy way back, and I want to think if was Quisenberry pitching at the time.
Eighth inning, yes. Quisenberry was pitching.
And I know that Schmitty and Bull had trouble with those submarine guys.
Yeah.
And then what happened was, though, if I remember right, I don't know if it was that game or not, but Schmitty ended up hitting a ball off of Brett, whether it was because he
yeah, later in the series, he did that.
Right.
But there was a couple of times. But the announcer said because Brett had been battling hemorrhoids, he wasn't moving very well.
And he was
playing back.
He was playing way back.
Yeah.
But the thing that I remember, because Schmitty brought it up to me, going out there, and when he did get the hit off Brett, he said, "See that fake bunt?" He said, "It paid off, didn't it?" I said, "Only you, Mike. Only you."
No kidding. If he rips one into the gap in the eighth inning, you guys call three games to none.
No question. Or if he hits a home run, the game's over.
Oh, and he bunted for a hit the next day. Now, that one was a little less egregious because you guys were already down 4-0.
Right, he tried to get on base.
Yeah. So
he did that a few times. Well, if we were down 3 or 4 runs and he was leading off or there was a man on, he would do that. He handled the bat good. But that play that you're talking about, we all were sitting in the dugout scratching our heads. Really?
So. Yeah, I thought the same thing. I'm thinking, boy, I hope he got killed for it in 1980 the same way he went in 2020.
The fact that we won, we were able to get on him. But at that time, you know, it wasn't a real good play. Dallas Green, really, he was like, what? You know.
Yeah, he was flipping out about that too.
Oh, yeah, big time.
Ooh, now, I didn't remember this probably because I was too young to really understand this dynamic of it. But the players and Dallas Green, that was not a fun relationship.
Well, the big thing there, I thought Dallas was the right guy at that time. Danny Ozark, to me, did a great job to handle our ball club. We had different personalities, and he basically let us play. He just said, go play. You know, we had a good, talented team, and we just couldn't get over the hump. And so Dallas came in, and you talk about two different personalities. His was completely different than Danny's, and it caught a few guys off guard. I mean, he comes in and he starts screaming and hollering and said, you guys aren't as good as you think you are. You've been reading too many press clippings. It's time for you to put up or Dallas. And that's, but to me, we needed that. We needed someone, even though it's up a couple times, I didn't like it at all. You know, I didn't like it as a player. We had a veteran team at that time and we knew what we had to do to win and for him to come in and start berating everybody, but he did it because, you know, he wanted to light a fire under us, and it worked. And I look back on that. I don't know if we win a World Series without Dallas. I really don't. That's how much he meant.
You get to game 4, and this is where the Royals even the series. It's a day game in Kansas City. And the thing that really sticks out about that game, it's kind of a turning point, is now they won the game, but they're up 5-1, and Dickie Knowles comes in, and he leveled George Brett on a pitch. Knocked him down, and the whole series changed right there.
There's no doubt in my mind that was the big pitch that, if you want to say, turned everything around. It got everybody excited on our team. I mean, it was a good one, too. I mean, I don't like seeing anybody get thrown at in the head. You know, you want to hit somebody. This was right at his head.
Yeah.
And it might have been one of the better. You know, when a right-hander throws at a left-hander's head, that is very obvious, you know.
Mm-hmm.
If a left-hander did it to a left-hander, you say, oh, it got away from him or right, but when a right-hander comes all the way across and throws it at a left-hander's head, that was something. Then Jim Frey comes out screaming, and Pete Rose is screaming at Jim Frey, get back in the dugout. You don't know what you're talking about. We ain't knocking him down. And if I remember right, they jumped out on us big time. Larry Christensen didn't have anything. He gave up 5 runs quick.
Yep.
And our bullpen did a great job. I think Dickie Knowles and Kevin Soche and I think Warren Brewster, they came in and they didn't give up a run. I mean, or if they did, it might have been one run. But I think Aikens got a big hit again. It might have been it was a home run.
He hit a home run off of Knowles. Christian. That was the only one. Yep.
Yeah, it was a bomb, too. And,
but why was throwing at Brett, like, what happened there? There wasn't, was there bad blood? Were people talking about stuff?
Well,
something happened on the field?
I think it had a lot to do with all those hitters stepping out, standing in the batter's box. And Dickie Knowles at that time, Dickie Knowles has turned out to be one super human being now. He turned his life completely around.
Yeah.
But at that time, he was a little goofy. And he didn't like these guys stepping out. And he says, you know, this is bullshit. I remember, you know, this is, you know, get in there and hit. We're not, we're just play the game. And I guess he took it into his own hands to get their best player. And, I mean, it was a good one. I thought maybe he might have done it to Otis or Akins because they've been wearing us out. But he did it to George Brett. And to this day, George says it was – he saw his life flash before his eyes, you know, so –
So you've now watched these guys play for four games, and that's the year that Brett came really close, a couple of hits away from hitting 400 for the year. He finishes at 390. He's the MVP of the American League. You mentioned Fitz, the MVP of the National League. But as we talked about, you don't get a lot of chances to watch these guys play.
No.
And not even on TV. You're not watching these guys back in 1980. So as you're watching George Brett play the first four games of that series, you know what his reputation is, and now you watch him hit. What do you think?
Right. I thought he was I knew he was a great hitter. I didn't realize that he was that good a hitter. He had a tremendous eye, didn't swing at a lot of bad pitches, controlled the strike zone, and when he got in the hitter's count, he hurt the baseball. It was tough to defend him. You know, if he was playing now, there's no way you could put a shift on George Brett. He hit the ball where it was pitched. He could drive the ball to left center. He could hit the ball at the ballpark. He was a gap-to-gap hitter with great bat speed. And, you know, he was – every time you see him, seeing him come up, you held your breath. He was that good a hitter. And we knew that going in, but I didn't realize he was that good a hitter. I mean, he impressed the heck out of me.
I'm also curious what you think about Hal McCray. Now, I know he was in the National League when you first came up playing with the Reds, but he's been with the – Royals for a long time heading into this series. And I've seen, you know, all these old highlights of Willie Randolph. I talked to Willie Randolph a bunch about how Hal McCray used to barrel into him at second base.
Oh, and we had the report.
Yeah. You know. So, it came up a couple, he was on base a lot. So you could tell, it happened to you, but it happened to Manny Trio where he kind of quick got out of the way because you knew what Hal McCray could do if he came barreling into you.
Right. I mean, we were told before the series even started, Manny and myself, you guys better get rid of the ball because this guy doesn't like to slide. And when he does slide, he slides real late. He sort of like he rolls into second base. And we would talk about that the whole series. If he was on first, hey, give me the ball quick. Give it to me quick. I mean, his reputation was not only was he a good hitter, but he was one of those guys that tried to hurt you at second. And I don't mean hurt in a way. He tried to break up a double play to get that guy at first, but keep that guy at first base. And at that time, there was no body length or anything like that. I try to tell guys now when they're playing, you guys have no clue about what it was like when those guys came in the second.
Yeah.
And that's why, as an infielder, we used to get the neighborhood play. You didn't have to stay on the back. The umpires would say, hey, just get close, because they knew exactly what runners were trying to do. So we got by with some neighborhood plays, which you can't do now. But on the other hand, these guys can't come after you like they did back then.
Well, everybody was sliding. You know, I mean, Chase Utley is why the rules are where they are right now. But you watch everybody slide on both teams back then, and you're aiming for the player. It doesn't matter if you can reach the base or not.
They could care less if they're going to the bag. If it's a double play, they're going to try to knock you into left field. And that was just the way. And it wasn't just Kansas City. That's how you were taught to play. And that's so it wasn't anything different for us because – we got it all season, all the time. You know, no matter who we played in the National League, that's how they played the game. Bill Madlock was with the Pirates and Cubs. He would try to go down there and knock you into left field. And it was almost like it's not a big deal. That's how you're supposed to do it. And now, if that happened now, man, guy might get suspended for a week.
You know, I just remembered that another thing they mentioned early in that series, I think Seaver brought this up, or Kubek, I forget. They said, late in the season, Dave Parker came into you, and you were still dealing with some shoulder soreness or something like that because of one of those incidents. Do you remember that?
I do know that he hit me pretty good. The only thing I remember about Pittsburgh, Swain, it didn't matter where we played or when we played. It seemed like there was always a bench-clearing call. Whether it be a hitter, whether it would be a guy knocking a guy out down at second base, it didn't matter. And you know, back then, guys, if your shortstop or second baseman got hit and the pitchers thought it was a bad slide, they would take matters into their own hands and, you know, and that let the guy know this is not what you're supposed to do. But, yeah, Dave Parker used to come in really hard. And you know, that was, but again, we didn't really complain about that stuff. That was just, that was the way the game was played then. And I'm glad we played like that. I mean, I don't know if I'd like to play right now with these rules. You can't hit the catcher. You can't make sure you go straight into the bag. I don't know. I think
it
you're
takes
taking
away some of your instincts, I would think.
It takes your instincts away and it takes your aggressiveness away. I mean, if you've got a guy at first and third, like, you know, I'm going to bring up Utley. Yeah, that was a big play, because if he breaks up the double play, the guy at third scores, and it was a big run.
Right.
And he did exactly that. And to me, was it in that era, was it a bad play as far as dirty? I never thought it was a dirty play. I thought the shortstop, first of all, I don't think it was a double play ball. And once that shortstop turned his back to the runner, he's got to try to get an out and get out of there.
Right.
But, you know, obviously the way it looked and what happened to the second baseman, it didn't come across too good. But they got the run, and at that time, it was a big run.
All right, so I want to move to Game 5. And the funniest thing to me about Game 5 is watching all the American League hitters react to Dutch Rennert for the very first time. I remembered, you know, the games, watching the games and listening to games on the radio, you could hear Dutch Rennert barking out the strikes from wherever you were in the ballpark. But I'm watching the very first time through the order, Willie Wilson, George Brett, they get called strike one, and Dutch Rennert, legendary home plate umpire, screams out, strike one.
Oh, yeah.
And everybody can hear him, but these hitters have never seen him before. So their reactions were hysterical to me.
I know it. Dutch, to me, was one of the better umpires in baseball. I mean, he had a great strike zone. And as you said, there was no hesitation. If it was a strike, you heard about it. If you never heard him umpire, I could understand them getting the expressions on their faces and everything, saying, wow, where'd this guy come from? He was a very good umpire. And we were used to that. Obviously, we saw him all year. But the first time I ever faced, remember him behind home plate, caught me way off guard. I went, wow. You know, I thought he was trying to just say, hey, that's a strike. But that's how he called the game. So,
well, even the rest of the umpires in that series, they really enjoyed the theatrics of ringing a guy up, whether it was strike three or an out on the bases. I mean, that's, you know, it's, you don't see anybody do that today.
No, they don't. And you I guess they're used to a lot of strikeouts now, so they can't
tire them out, right? Wow.
Yeah, I remember that. You know, the big thing about that game, if I remember right, McGraw threw three innings in relief. Unbelievable. I mean, he was on fumes, believe me. He'd be behind hitters, which he normally didn't do, but he was out of gas, and we rode him hard. But, and again, Unser got a big hit. Schmitty got a big hit, and we won that game 4-3. I think we came from behind and got two runs in the ninth inning. We were down.
Yes.
You know, that was a huge game. If we lose that game there, I don't know, man. The momentum obviously goes the other way there. They sweep us in Kansas City. But to come back and win that game was huge for us.
And you're talking about being in fumes. He's in his third inning, and he's loaded the bases.
Right.
It's a one-run ball game, so he's loaded the he pitches around basically Amos Otis, who's up with two men on base. He basically intentionally walks him. And now you've got the winning run is at second base. He's got nothing left. And
nothing.
He's facing Jose Cardinal. I mean,
and I think he hit a foul ball. He crushed it.
Yes, very first pitch,
mistaken.
I think. Yep.
Yep, down the left field line, because it was like a mediocre fastball, and I went, uh-oh. Because when he swung, Cardinal could hit a fastball, and I went, oh, no, and it was foul. But, he didn't have too much at the end there.
And it was weird. There's this little cat and mouse games. I think there were two strikes, and Boone goes out to the mound, and they're kind of, you know, tinkering around a little bit, and then they go back. And then it's strike three to Cardinal to win the game. But I mean, he just didn't seem everybody in the ballpark seemed to know that there wasn't much.
No, there wasn't.
The tank at that point.
And Booney had a knack of being able to slow it down a little bit. Booney would know if he was short, and he knew the holes. I remember on the airplane, he said, man, Tug's short, man, he's short. And every time he would call timeout to go to the mound, I know he's giving him a blow and pumping him up saying, hey, you got – Don't give up on the fastball, because he's having trouble with his screwball getting it over. And but it was like, he says, I got nothing, man. He was throwing balls down the middle of the plate. But, you know, he took the ball. And again, if I'm not mistaken, in game six, I think he pitched multiple innings again. I think he pitched two innings game six.
Yep.
And again, that was the big play was the pop-up that Booney and Pete went over by the dugout.
That yeah, was, what do you was, remember seeing when you were watching that? Where were you? Were you standing just right in your position?
Yeah, I thought it was out of play, to be honest with you. And then I looked up again, and everyone talks about Pete making a great play reaction, but if you look at that, Booney ran a long way for that.
Yeah.
And he was almost to the first base side. The dugouts were real long. I guarantee he was closer to first than he was home when he stuck his glove out and it came off, and Pete obviously was right there and caught it. And that when that happened, there was a bunch of things, but when that happened, I went, we're not losing this. There's no way. And then, then they threatened again in the ninth in that game, and the horses came out on the field, and, there was a lull in the action, and there's men on base, and I'm sitting there going, oh, my God. Because I remember playing in my backyard, not saying I was the Phillies, but I would say there's a ground ball, hit the ball, he picks it up, throws the first, and they win the World Series. And I used to say, hit me the ball. And yeah. At that particular time, I went, I don't know if I want this ball hit at me right now. Because there was a long delay. It seemed like an hour, but I know it wasn't. But
yeah.
the horses came on. They didn't want anybody rushing the field and everything. And then Tug eventually, Willie Wilson, to me, if he has the kind of series he's supposed to have, that series could be completely reversed.
Yeah.
But he was in one of those funks, and he was missing pitches right down the middle. And Tug ended up striking him out. The fastball was right there. I mean, right there. And he swung right through it. And I think he got 230-plus hits that year.
He did.
Yeah, he was crushing balls. And then during the World Series, he couldn't buy a hit.
I think he struck out 12 times in the series.
Oh, I know.
Yeah.
And there were balls down the middle of the plate. He was getting pitchers to hit.
So one of the things that that they say, you guys are like three outs away from winning, and Tony Kubek is talking about the relationship again between Dallas Green and the players. And he mentions you had a radio show, and he said even just the week before the World Series, you were blasting Dallas Green, or late in the season, you were blasting Dallas Green as this was coming down to the wire. Now, what are the details about this show that you did? And do you remember what you
were saying? Well, I remember doing the show, and I remember the reason it was I don't know if I blasted him. I said some things. You know, Gary Maddux and Leszczynski were our basically our left fielder and center fielder all year. Mm-hmm. And so Dallas, he had a way of getting these guys' attention, and literally he would take them out. He had Lonnie Smith playing center field. He had Keith Moreland playing left field. And I'll take my hat off to both those guys. They came up big when they got a chance to play. And I think it was a question from a listener saying, what about Dallas not playing Leszczynski and Maddux during the course towards the end of the year? And then I said something, I can't believe he did that. Without those two guys in the lineup, we probably don't even get to the World Series or playoffs. And so obviously that was blown out big time. Mm-hmm. But I don't think anything else about it. I like the way Dallas, his intensity, and I thought he got our attention at the right time when he was supposed to. And as I told you earlier in this podcast, I don't think we win the World Series without Dallas as a manager.
Schmidt gets named the MVP, but a lot of guys had big series that you could make the case for. You and Boone in particular played very well defensively, but you guys, you hit 375, Boone hit over 400. Tug McGraw only gave up one run and gone on fumes and pitching as many innings as he did. There were a lot of guys who could have made that case for MVP.
I remember Frank Dolson, who was one of the writers here in Philadelphia at the mm-hmm. time, and he told me that up until Schmidt's last hit, he says the votes that he thought were posted is that I was going to win MVP.
Wow.
And Schmidt got a big hit. He got a big double. And, that was really, that would have been nice, but that was the least of my worries. I was just glad that we were able to finally win a World Series, because before that season started in 80, Rulli Carpenter, who I think was one of the best owners I have ever been around, told us basically, hey, guys, you got to do it this year. I'm going to have to break up this team. Because, and he was honest about it. He loved everybody in that clubhouse, but he says, we need to get over this hump. So we were playing for a mission basically the whole year, that we knew that if we didn't get to the World Series anyway, I'm not saying he told us to win it. He said, you need to get to the World Series. And we were, but eventually they tore the team up a little bit. But the fact that from 75 on, it was a real good baseball team. In fact, mm-hmm. they're doing a simulated thing right now with the 08 team and 80 team, and right now they played 3 games and we're up 2-1. So I'm anxious to see how that turns out.
You know, the one thing I was disappointed at as I was watching the end of this, I was watching the celebration. They show all the clubhouse interviews with Brian Gumbel, who's doing this the podium ceremony and handing the trophy over. You're the first guy they interview coming in, and they get a bunch of everybody else. But the thing I remember, and I've seen the quotes, and I vividly remember watching you out of your mind saying, "We're the best baseball team in the United States of America. Nobody yep. else can say that." But yep. that is not in the interview that you give Brian Gumbel right after you come into the clubhouse. It's some other time later, and I haven't seen it since. But you remember doing that.
I do remember doing that, and I remember the other part of that interview was because all year our writers at that time, we had, you know, back then the writers were different. It's not like now. I mean, they took shots at us, and we weren't the easiest guys to get along with. I'm gonna be honest with you. We all had different personalities. There were times you could talk to us, you know, sometimes nobody wanted to talk, but we always stood up. And I said, I remember saying, no one thought we could win. Sports writers thought this team was overrated. I remember going into a tirade that way, but it wasn't on that. The one that you saw is the one that they showed, you know, that we're the best team. But I do remember saying that because there was a time in September where we hit a little lull. And things weren't going our way. And, of course, all the press, they got on that real quick and start saying this team's never going to win. They think they're better than they are. And then I think Dallas got a lot of that stuff, too. And that's why I aired us out a bunch of times. But, it was looking back on it. It was a lot of fun. It was a team that it was a pretty close-knit team. You know, yeah. we had different personalities, but it was a team, you know, Bull and Schmitty were basically low key guys that did damage, and me and Pete and Bake McBride would be, and Manny Trio would be the instigators. Gary Maddox was pretty low key. Booney was even keel, but we had the right mix, it seemed like.
Do you know if you still hold the record? They made a point of it as soon as you started your seventh double play. You broke a record that Phil Rizzuto held in 51 for most double plays started by a shortstop. Do you know if you still hold that?
I think it is in 6 games. I don't know if it's, you know, I'm not positive, though. Yeah. I'm not positive.
So do you find yourself looking back on these things every once in a while?
Now I do because they show, especially here in Philly, they show a lot of that stuff. And, you know, some of it you sort of forget, like, The series that people that really forget about is we had to go into Montreal and win 2 out of 3
yes.
to get. And I'll never forget this. They had first base open, and Mike Schmidt was the hitter. We had taken out our catcher, Booney, and Don McCormick. We made a double switch or something, and Don McCormick was on deck. And Dick Williams with Stan Bonson on the mound. Pitched to Schmitty, and he hit a home run, and I'm going, oh, you got to be kidding me. Because when Schmitty jumped up there with first base open, I went, there's no way they're pitching to Schmitty here. We were down, and they pitched to Schmitty, and he hit a 2-run homer with 1 by a run. But Don McCormick, who might have had maybe 20 at-bats the whole year.
Yeah.
And Dick Williams, who I thought was a real good manager, I still, to this day, can't believe that they pitched to Schmitty. But we had to win that series, and we won two out of three there in Montreal to get to play the Houston Astros.
I remember that game. There was a long rain delay, I think, in the
middle of
that
God,
game,
it was
right?
pouring.
Yeah.
It was that turf was – I've never played – you know, I've been on turfs before, but that turf was as wet as I've ever seen. When they hit a ground ball, it would have a tail on it because they got the tarp on real late. It poured. And it was hard to play defense there, but it was a bad rainstorm there.
I also remember Manny Trio dropping a pop up somewhere in the middle of that game.
There was some weird stuff in that series, and Manny never dropped pop ups.
Exactly.
He used to love pop ups,
but
there was weird stuff. I think Larry Christensen was pitching that game too.
So I want to leave with this. I don't know if the ceremony is going to happen this year because everything we're going through, but Derek Jeter is going into the Hall of Fame. He was elected to the Hall of Fame.
Right.
And I know you got to spend a couple of years. You've been around a lot of great players, played right. with them, managed them, coached them.
Right.
But I remember you had a certain view on Jeter as, you know, the 2 years that you coached with the Yankees and worked with the infielders. And right. he was already a superstar that by that point. But
yep.
getting to see him up close every day for 2 years, I know it kind of changed your view on him. What are your thoughts on him as he goes into the Hall of Fame this year?
Well, first of all, I knew he was a great player. I mean, just by watching. But to watch him play every day, day in and day out, very seldom. I can't remember mental mistakes this guy ever made. He was always in the right place at the right time. I think the biggest thing with Jeet is he always wanted to be hitting with the game on the line. It didn't matter. And if he didn't come through on a Monday night, he wanted to be up there on a Tuesday night. And I asked him, I said, man, how do you keep coming up with big hit after big hit? He goes, you know, I know that this is a game of failure and you're going to fail. You're going to fail. He says, but I love those situations. And I know pitchers don't like facing me because my reputation is I'm going to get a hit. But to watch him make routine plays and run the bases and just his preparation prior to game, it was the same every single day. His BP was first two rounds. He'd hit everything to right field, then he'd pull some balls. His routine in the field was he'd take ground balls with the infield in, then he'd go back and you hit him right, you hit him left. But he never altered his pregame ever. And he was just a professional. And to play in New York under the spotlight there and never get in any kind of trouble, I mean, I got to take my hat off to a guy like that. He was single playing there, a very popular individual, and just played the game the way you're supposed to play it. And I was just shocked that it wasn't a unanimous thing. I don't know who didn't vote for him, but, you know, it doesn't matter. I mean, it really doesn't matter. But
you were a pretty good shortstop back in the day, and by the time you saw him up close, he had been taking some hits for his range and things like that. What did you think of him defensively at the time you saw him?
I thought he was a good player defensively. I thought what he lacked for in range, he made up for in knowledge. He always we went over how to play hitters, and he knew where to play. I mean, if they had all this analytic stuff as deep as it is now, he probably could have played a few more years because they basically position you now. Hey, this is where you're supposed mm-hmm. to stand. But he was always what he lacked in range at the end, he made up for in knowledge. And he was just a great player. And it's a great honor for him to go into this thing.
Bo, it was a treat for me watching these games again because I hadn't watched, other than some highlight films every once in a while, I hadn't seen them in 40 years, and I know you lived it. So thanks for letting me bother you about it all over the years and again right now.
All right, Sweeney, my pleasure, and stay safe, and hopefully we see you somewhere. I guess some of the stuff says that, I don't believe everything, but they said they might break it up into Florida and Arizona, and then if it was Florida,
yeah.
I guess the Yankees and us would be in the same division.
Wouldn't that be something, huh?
Yeah, that would be, but I tell you what, the Yankees and Phillies, they got three patsies in that division.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, there's three teams that are Detroit's rebuilding, Pittsburgh's not that good, Toronto's got some good young players, but they lack experience. So it's probably going to be if it did go that way, it would probably be between the Yankees and the Phillies.
Hey, listen, it just struck me, and I should ask you about this before we leave. You know, I know there wasn't a whole lot of time to observe them, but Joe Girardi, Didi Gregorius, guys that we know well in New York, you got to see them a little bit up close in spring training. What'd you think?
I love both of them. Joe's going to be – he's perfect match here. Very knowledgeable, and I think he takes the analytics, but he also goes with his gut and his experience, and obviously being successful in New York, he'll be successful here. Didi Gregorius I really like. I mean, he might have got one or two hits the whole spring. But this guy's personality and his energy, and he can play shortstop, and he's going to hit. Believe me, he's going to hit. I was just shocked after watching him, this way he goes about his business, they didn't have more. I know he got hurt, and he had Tommy John, but I was shocked they didn't have more offers on the table because I think this guy, he's going to add a lot. If we're able to play, he's going to add a lot to our lineup. I really like this kid.
My thanks again to Larry Boa. His insights are terrific, and I'm glad I wasn't the only one who was floored watching a man who was once seventh on the all-time home run list bunt in the eighth inning of a World Series game with the go-ahead run at third base and two outs. I don't know when we'll get back to real baseball, people. I really don't. But until then, I'm pretty sure I will head back to some of these games on YouTube that I haven't seen in a while or perhaps never seen. And maybe we'll do this again here and go over the games with someone who was actually there. If you're new here, please check out the 30 with Murdy archive on radio.com or wherever you get your podcasts. A lot of fun conversations in sports and entertainment. And you can also check out my weekly chats with Ed Coleman, where we discuss Mets, Yankees, general baseball, news and views, other random thoughts from our quarantine. And that's available on the WFAN Audio On Demand page. You can always find links to all this stuff on my Twitter page at YankeesWFAN. Everyone remember, keep doing your part to flatten the curve. Stay home, go wash your hands again right now. In fact, stay safe. And until next time, I'm Sweeney Murdy. Thank you for listening.
What up, y'all? It's your boy Danny Green, three-time NBA champ. You either rooted for me or rooted against me. Join myself and my co-host Harrison Sanford on the Inside the Green Room podcast.
It's a podcast that brings you never-before-told tales from the locker room to candid interviews with basketball legends to breakdowns of what's happening in the NBA right now. Whether you're a diehard fan or casual about your hoops, this podcast brings you the game like never before.
Follow Inside the Green Room on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.